come join the conversation, the show that you've been wanting. Keep it real with no filter, weekly we share discussions. WWSD, interviewing creative guests, talking the creative process and sharing all the influences from TV and film. Emmy nominated and winning, yeah, they coming through. Actors and comedians too, directors and writers, way more than a few. Masters of their craft, yes, tune in, you gotta see. This the podcast that you need, WWSD.
Welcome to the WWSD podcast. Weekly, we share discussions with interesting and creative people. I'm your host, Josh, and as always, I'm joined by my buddy and co-host, Seamus. How's it going, Seamus?
Doing great, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Cool. Who do you have on tonight?
Tonight, we got a very, very awesome guest. We are joined by comedian and television writer, Tim Barnes. Tim created the Comedy Central animated web series, Maurice on Mars. Tim has also written for The Tonight Show, starring Jimmy Fallon, Nickelodeon's reboot of All That, plus much more. Tim, it's an absolute pleasure having you on our podcast this evening. How you doing, man?
Thank you for having me on. It just clicked that I actually have a pretty cool resume. Look at that. It's kind of surreal. It's like a resume I wish I could like send a little message to myself in elementary school. Like, look what you're doing. Yeah.
When you were a kid, did you think you were going to get in the entertainment industry or would you go college?
Sort of. My first true goal in life was to invent Flubber. I had read the novelization of the Robin Williams version of Flubber, and that was my first true passion. But then I realized that if I were going to invent Flubber, I'd have to get at math, not good at math. And then it clicked. The reason I want to invent Flubber is because of the power of cinema. So my goal was to be a filmmaker. My only higher education is 2 years of City College at Santa Barbara City College because they had a good film program. I grew up in LA, in South Central LA. My family moved to the Inland Empire my last year of middle school. Enjoyed film, stopped going to Santa Barbara City College, had moved back home to with my parents, was working at a movie theater, slowly started doing stand-up comedy. Now I feel like I'm kind of getting back into the world of creation. I'm also doing stand-up and I'm also doing a lot of writing. It's like all of my dreams are in this weird sort of amorphous creativity thing.
Kind of firing on all cylinders. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
You started comedy in California?
Yes, very briefly in California. Yeah.
What city were you in when you started?
I technically started in that same area in the Inland Empire in Riverside, California.
I've never heard that before, the Inland Empire.
The Inland Empire. Yeah. Doesn't it sound amazing? David Lynch actually made a movie called The Inland Empire or called Inland Empire. It's like this wide ranging sort of ever expanding part of Southern California. I think it's like 3 hours south of Los Angeles. And it's just a weird area. It's like when I think of it, it's a reminder that California is the tail end of manifest destiny. You know what I mean? Like this is like California really, people think they know what it is, but they don't. It is just like little patches of neighborhoods, and it feels very, I don't know, they just feel like little territories that there's just weird roads. Like it's not on a grid or anything. The city, Los Angeles, and everything in California does not make any god dang sense.
So you started doing comedy in the Inland Empire. Did you go for an open mic? Was that your first experience with comedy?
Yeah, the first experience, if I'm remembering correctly, I had two friends who were in a band, and they knew that I wanted to do stand-up because I was just the type of person who would repeat the same sort of casual conversational jokes at parties experimentally, like just naturally, just to kind of see if they land in the same way and to get to that sense of like ease in social settings. I just kind of found like there's a mathematics to jokes, and especially if they're sort of conversational. One example is when people would ask me where I'm from, I would say I'm from a small town in African America. And that's a joke that kind of I still say in my stand up today. And so they asked me to open for one of their bigger shows in Los Angeles. I was nervous about that. And so in preparation for that, I started to go to these small open mics in Riverside. And they'd usually be like music open mics, poetry open mics. Open mics where I would be the only comedian, really. Actually, like a great way to start, I think, because you have a sort of realistic audience as opposed to open mics where it's just comedians thinking about their own sets the whole time.
Yeah, they don't fucking care.
So, yeah. I know.
That's actually cool. I never thought about that, actually having an audience of like people. Because like if you're there for music, like, you're going to listen to the comedian and all that.
It's a real balanced audience too, because like they're not there for comedy, so they're not necessarily degenerates, you know.
Yeah.
And then they feel kind of special when the comic goes up, you know what I mean? Because it's like so unexpected compared to everything else. But I don't consider myself in like sort of LA comic or California comic, because a good friend of mine, Ian Abramson, I went to high school with him. We both realized that we wanted to do comedy. So we hatched this plan to save up as much money as we could to move to Chicago. I had just read that Del Close book, Truth in Comedy. I thought that, Chicago is this land of comedic opportunity. And so we moved out there with like less than $3,000, and I didn't have a job set up. And so it truly felt like an alien crash landing and trying to figure out how to survive. That's my memory of Chicago. And that's why I hold it so fondly. I consider myself at my core sort of a Chicago comic. And we started off going to Second City. I remember I took a sketch class. We were doing jam sessions. You know what they call that in improv? Jam sessions. That's when you're just practicing improv with other people. They call it jam sessions. I always thought that was kind of silly and pretentious a little bit. Yeah. And I was like, do you want to jam? Like, it's so funny that that's a common term in improv. And so it's kind of funny. We ended up like doing these jam sessions with this group of students from DePaul, because friend Ian knew someone there. That group of college improvisers had pitched a show to Second City. I don't know if they still have it, but it was called like Donnie Skybox. So within like a month or so of us moving to Chicago, we were in this group that had a show at Second City. So we were doing improv at Second City. And to me, that was the first sign that having experienced that improv is not for me. I would rather focus on stand-up, where the buck stops at me if it's good or if it's bad. That was sort of my preference, and I kind of kept that going. But while doing a lot of stand-up, I was also doing a lot of sort of behind-the-scenes media production kind of jobs. And I kind of had to build up to that as well. My first job in Chicago was as a host at the California Pizza Kitchen in downtown Chicago. And after that, I was working at a Dunkin' Donuts. But because I was in the stand-up scene, and I had like all I knew about Chicago was This American Life, really. And I love This American Life. And so as someone who did a lot of video editing, was interested in film, like I have these sort of skills of being able to edit and stuff like that. So I was like, I want to be producer at This American Life. Those are my two goals in Chicago, being a great stand-up comedian and being a producer at This American Life.
Wait, Don't Tell Me is in Chicago too, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And I ended up writing for them at one point.
That's cool.
On a sort of like a temp basis. It was sort of like an experimental, let's see if you're a good fit kind of thing, I think. Okay, so I was doing a lot of stand-up, and there's this comedian, Brian Babylon, who's on Wait, Don't Tell Me a lot. He's a Chicago-based comedian, lives in LA now, but he hosted a morning radio show for this radio station called Vocalo that is the sister station to WBEZ. You got to brace yourselves. I have a lot of stories like this where it's just caveats upon caveats upon caveats. Good. So he had this morning, he was a co-host of this morning radio show called The Morning Amp. And I had, when I first, so I moved out there, didn't have a lot of prospects. I'm trying to figure out how to survive as a human being, how to survive creatively, how to feel like I'm a part of some sort of community. And I remember one person told me, like, you should try volunteering. What if you go to volunteermatch.com? And so the first volunteer job I got there was to volunteer for a Polish historical museum. I think that's what it was. There's a big Polish population in Chicago. It's the biggest Polish population in the US, I think.
That's what the jungle's about, right? Up to Sinclair.
Yeah. So I was doing that, and what was great about volunteering, remember I had no money, is that usually you're volunteering for events where there's free food. So I was really sort of like living the struggling artist life in a way that to me now is like hard to comprehend and hard to understand how I got through a lot of it. But okay, so one of those, WBEZ has these sister stations, or not sister stations, but they have these bureaus at different parts of Chicago. So in one of these things where I was still volunteering for the Polish Museum, they had some sort of event with one of those sister stations. Someone who was part of WBEZ, I was chatting with her, and she got me into the web of sort of being a volunteer at WBEZ. So then Brian Babylon, this comedian who has a host at the sister station to WBEZ start seeing me at comedy shows and also volunteering for radio events. And at one point, he just walks up to me and says, "Dude, who the hell are you?" And I kind of explained that, took a sort of liking to me, and it's like, "All right, I'm going to get you to volunteer for my morning radio show." So that was my first official media job. It was an unpaid internship, but felt like a step forward, so much so that in my belief in my ability to make it in the world of media, I quit my job at Dunkin' Donuts. And that was another patch of time where I don't necessarily know how I survived. And I realize you haven't asked a question in about 10 minutes, so feel free to.
I want to go back to improv. You said it wasn't for you. I'm interested in why. Why was improv not for you?
I am not a good improviser. I don't believe that I am.
That's odd because, like, you know, I was watching you on those Comedy Central panels. It seemed like you were good at it. Seemed like you're good off the cuff, at least.
I think so. But I think improv requires becoming what the scene needs. And I don't think I'm ever really what the scene needs.
You're always yourself.
I'm always myself. Yeah. And so I would be in a lot of moments where it's clear to everybody, it's clear to the other improvisers, it's clear to the audience that, you know, someone needs to walk on stage and pretend to be a peacock. And in my mind, I'm like, I recognize that, but I'm not going to do it. You know what I mean? Like,
you just want to go out there and like start doing crowd work,
just make people laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, isn't this fucking lame? Like, what are they doing?
Well, I just can't. And it's the type of comedian I am. Like, I'm jealous of even stand-up comics who can embody characters, who can do act outs. I am stuck in the lane of verbal comedy and like that sort of verbal math of jokes. It's really hard for me to do. That's the magic of what the great improvisers do. And I'm kind of jealous of that. I hope that people who are good at improv and act outs are jealous of what I can do. But I'm very, very jealous of that.
So I feel like there's more upside in what you can do.
It's a bit biased. Damn. Fuck those improv guys. No, it's funny because like we talked to a lot of comedians that did start with improv, like kind of with the first thing they were able to do, like they actually like perform in front of people, and they all like, "I really hate improv. I never want to do it again." Like it's like a real hard divide with a lot of stand-up comedians. It's so funny. I don't think we really found any comedians that did improv that still do improv. They kind of just go really hard into stand up and all. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the improvisers who go into stand up do very well. They have like such a great base and know how to tap into a certain something when the circumstance needs it. I think improvisers do great in writers' rooms as well, because it's so communal. There's that lack of ego that good improvisers have, and that's always very great in a writer's room. There's a lot to be gained from it. The question is, can you have a career as an improviser? I think that's a little more difficult, but you can take those skills and translate them into other things very well.
Yeah, especially like Second City, like it feeds really well into like Saturday Night Live and stuff like that, and you can get into like that sketch comedy scene potentially if you're good enough.
That feeling is what I hated about Second City. That weird cultish feeling where you know everyone who's paying for these classes has one specific goal, and that goal is one show that happens once a week. That was a little weird to deal with.
It's funny, like Jimmy Fallon and all, he went to the Groundlings in California and all, which is very similar to Second City with the improv and stuff. I think that's really interesting that he went, did that, but he went into like late night television and all. And it's kind of a 180 from the actual like sketch comedy of like SNL, but I guess it's kind of similar still.
Yeah, he does a lot of sketches and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if he ever imagined he would be hosting a late night show. Like, you know what I mean? Because he had that movie with Queen Latifah, you know?
Yeah, we had one of his original improv teachers from the Groundlings on, Jim Wise. He actually worked on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno and Mad TV and stuff like that. And he said the first day he came in, he's like, "I'm going to be on SNL." Like that was like literally like his first day in class. Everyone's like, "Okay, dude, whatever." Everyone says that, sure.
Yeah.
I think Jimmy Fallon probably does really well in a place where he's allowed to laugh whenever he wants, you know.
Hey, I laugh a lot too. I have a little insecurity sometimes when I laugh so much. I wonder if people think, "Oh, he's a Jimmy Fallon laugher." Oh, no.
I remember he used to always like break on SNL.
And oh, sport. yeah. But, you know, when I first got to Chicago, Chris Redd, I believe, is from Chicago, but he was at Second City. I would see him around Second City. And then I saw him as he kind of went from, he's still a great improviser, but he started doing a lot of stand-up as well. I haven't thought about this in a while, but I knew that he was pretty big at Second City when I had first moved to Chicago and I was seeing him around. And so if I'm remembering correctly, when I was a host at the California Pizza Kitchen, he came in, I think he might've had a date. I sat them and everything. And I think I kind of just like had a moment of like, I'm a big fan of your work and that kind of thing. And then later on, we were like kind of, we did a couple shows together. He's like proof of like the sort of tenacity that it takes to make it onto SNL. He is someone who even back then, I could tell that he had what it took to get there and that he had a very specific drive that was kind of inspiring. But yeah, Second City just kind of gave me the creeps a little as well.
It seemed like everyone's like they're drinking the Kool-Aid. Like I kind of feel like, like the way that people talk about it does sound a bit cultish, which is, I guess it kind of works for them.
It's like a cult that also makes your parents happy. Because like, that's what I said when I moved to Chicago. It's like, yeah, I'm taking official comedy classes from this historic institution. And there are grades and levels. And
The more you describe it, And then like you eventually start working for the company and then it's like, well, you're not really getting paid very well. So you're kind of doing like, it's all for free.
I would do volunteer stuff for them too. Cause they had a sort of like, if you volunteer, then you get like this percentage off of your class or whatever. So it, you know, it has the potential to become what we all fear could be a cult.
Cult of stand up. Cool. So when you moved out to Chicago from California and you're doing stand-up, did like any of your jokes translate well to the Chicago crowd? Because they're kind of diverse compared to like people from California.
Yeah, I learned a lot about myself because my comedy is a little cerebral. And a couple comedians who were an inspiration for me, Ron Funches specifically. I remember back when I was still living in California, this was after I had left college and I had moved back home and I was working at this movie theater and I would come home miserable and just like pour a bowl of cornflakes, excitedly watch Conan's new TBS show because he had just gotten there. Comedians like Ron Funches were a true revelation to me because seeing his first Conan set and his first couple of Conan sets was like, wow, you can be a Black comedian and be weird and make it onto television. And it's like, that really did open the world of possibilities to me in a way that nothing else really had. Because I grew up in the time of you can only be Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle or Steve Harvey. You know what I mean?
You hadn't really seen yourself.
Exactly. And suddenly it was sort of this patch had opened up, specifically kind of this Conan TBS era. It feels like the kinds of comedians he was having on, revealing to me this alternative scene. And I moved to Chicago with that sort of energy of, you know, anything is possible. You have to remember Barack Obama was still president then. It was like kind of a magical time in retrospect in terms of like things that were possible.
What year was that?
2012?
Moved there February 2012, I believe. So the very beginning of 2012. And so like even like starting off in the stand-up scene there, the first things that we did were at Second City and there was like a stand-up comedy open mic in one of the theaters there. And so we started there, which is not the best sense of like how to get into stand-up. It's an interesting crowd that kind of shows up there, but definitely starting from the bottom, open mics. And Chicago is hyper-segregated, which is a horrible, bad thing. But in terms of the comedic skill that you can get from that, you learn how to do stand-up in very different segmented areas, very different groups in each of those areas. For me, particularly as a Black comedian who's not from the city, who grew up pretty sheltered in South Central LA, like I wasn't allowed to go around the block as a kid. Chicago was truly like the world opening up to me in terms of figuring out who I am as a person, while also figuring out who I am as a comedian. And so like I wouldn't say like Southside is like the heart of Black comedy in Chicago. I wouldn't say that I became like a Southside comedy regular. I definitely found my lane in sort of the alternative scene. I also definitely found my voice. I think after the first year that I was in Chicago, I wasn't focusing on comedy as much as focusing on figuring out how to survive. I was feeling kind of down about that. But then I kind of made a little bit of a switch in my head. Something that's kind of sustained me ever since of just like, okay, treat your hobby like it's work and treat your work like it's your hobby. Like really focus on comedy like it's your job and that this is what's paying the bills. And when I started going to these open mics, specifically this Bowles open mic, which to me was my favorite because it had this great culture with the comedians. There was always a patch of regular people there and it kind of felt like a show. So this might sound embarrassing, but I would pretend like I could hear the walk-on music that Conan has when comedians show up whenever I would walk on stage.
Oh, that looks like you up? Yeah, that's not bad. Yeah.
But beyond that, it was like, I have to kill as much as I can when I go on stage. And so that switch, it literally was just like a decision to focus on comedy really hard, paid off almost instantly. Like, I think just people could tell I started making a bit of a name for myself, and also still was kind of like not very categorizable and was still riding that wave of like doing a lot of stand up, but also doing very specific, like behind the scenes sort of media work, all things that like I felt until recently very uneasy about, because I was like, I don't know how people are thinking of me. I don't know if the comedians respect me, you know, because they like, is he a comedian or is he a podcast guy or is he a media guy who dabbles in comedy? When I first started actually writing for television, all of those skills came in handy and became as one sort of, specifically at like a show like The Tonight Show, where you are producing just as much as you're writing. And so all of the production work I had done over the years leading up to that kind of made it a little easier to deal with. It's not a shock. Like, I think some people who say start up as a stand-up comic and start writing for a show like that, it's a little bit of a learning curve.
You're saying that like there's this distinction between being a media person and a comedian. Can you speak about that a little bit more?
I don't know if it was all just in my head.
You didn't think you belonged?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Or
I guess it's the equivalent of like the TikTok people now. Like,
I think so. Especially in Chicago, there felt like there were the most respected comedians who dove so far into it, that was their entire identity. And that was like, you felt like that's what they did. What I loved especially when I first started, there was a sort of magic to the fact that you would see some of the most incredible people do some of the funniest comedy you could ever imagine seeing. And I had no idea what they did for a living to pay rent. and kind of no one talked about what they did. It kind of felt like a superhero or something. Like, learning what comedians do in the day was always a shock for me. And so really is the fun of stand-up is like these amazing, amazing people might have the weirdest day jobs, but at night they're basically gods, you know? But I think it's my struggle was just not knowing where I was on that balance. Am I truly a comedian? And I think so much of comedy, especially stand-up, really is a social beast. Your first goal really is to get all the other comedians to think of you as a comedian. And I think there is something about working in media that can make people feel like you didn't really earn your stripes. But as I've gotten older and as comedy has changed with technology and kind of merged into one, I don't feel that as much. And I'm much more content with the balance that I found, because I don't think my goal is to be a road dog or to even really have a Netflix special or anything like that. But at the time, that was kind of where my head was at. And now I think I've found more of an equilibrium with it.
Do you still feel like an outsider? Like you said, you still do comedy now.
I do. It's one of those things where outside of my friend Ian, who I moved there with, that I had a few people where I felt like I was a part of clique or a core group, but I never really dove in. I think this is where this turns into therapy. As a pretty sheltered kid who, you know, the schools I went to weren't necessarily exactly in my neighborhood, and I didn't have like sort of neighborhood friends, I grew up with a lot of compartmentalization, trying to unpack that. But I keep everyone in my life in their own little segments, and very rarely do they intertwine. Yeah.
100% understand that.
So I think that affected even in the comedy community. I kind of kept like, oh, comedy is this thing that I do. And then I dip out and I don't want to be in it. I don't want to be in the muck of all the conversation and the Game of Thrones of it all. I just want to do a great set and then leave. And
That's so interesting because, like, it's such a social being, like you said, where it's like networking is such a key aspect because, like, you meet comedians, they get you onto their show, and like it keeps expanding more and more opportunities for you. And so how'd you kind of like get to like the next level in stand up from like open mics to doing like, I guess, what were you hosting at some point? Or were you doing like any headlining or featuring?
Yeah, I think my first goal and every comedian's first goal is to get a really solid 5 minutes. And I don't know if open mics have changed too much, but in Chicago, you could easily get like 4 or 5 minutes at an open mic, sometimes 3. And so at some point, it really is about like killing with enough consistency that one of the bookers who's at one of these shows wants to put you on your show. And I remember the first show I did, I got booked on was, I don't remember the name of it. But I remember I got like $5 and it was the most glorious $5. And the burrito I bought with that $5 was like the greatest thing I've ever eaten. Yeah, I
know. I'm the king of comedy.
And it really, like, it's great, like the endorphins you get from it. And like with that first big show, I think River Butcher was on first show that I did, and it was so good getting to just like chat with him briefly. And he gave me some great advice that still I don't remember for some reason, but I remember just like the fact that River gave me that advice was just meant a lot, that he liked my set. And so little things like that would always give me a lot of motivation. But it's still, Twitter was a thing, you started being a thing in the internet. So like funny on the internet, funny in person, start getting booked on shows. My friend Ian and comedians, Melody Kamali, we started, we created this show called Double Feature. The idea was that filmmakers would send in their comedic short films, and then we'd also have headlining comedians. So it'd be short film, comedian. So that was a lot of fun. And then there's this pretty, I guess the word might be legendary, or this great open mic at this bar called Lottie's, and it's called the Lottie's Open Mic, that in some ways one of the coolest open mics, and in some ways also the most challenging open mic. It's in a basement. My friend Ian was co-hosting it with Megan Gailey at one point, and then Megan handed it to just him. And so Ian brought me on to co-host it with him. That was great. Like that's just like the open mic that kind of demanded an element of respect or something. Chicago is like a comedy scene that's all about respect. It's kind of amazing because it's not on either coast. There's not that pressure of potential media jobs or people in the industry being around to scout people. So it's very much like you can become a local legend or something, or an energy that's needed to rise up the ranks, and a path towards rising up the ranks. And at the same time, what are the ranks? Who knows? As soon as you leave, you realize that none of the stuff in that level of it really matters at all. But while you're in it, that's your whole world. I guess the stand-up comedy scene in Chicago is a bit of an equivalent to the improv cult. Exists there too.
When you're still like developing your voice, was there a particular like archetype that you were trying to model or that you were trying to go after? Like whether it was with your voice or the kinds of jokes you were doing?
I think when I started, it was probably more in the Stephen Wright area. Embarrassingly, maybe a little bit more of the Woody Allen area. It's a shame that some of his work was inspirational to me, I suppose. But which are not the comedians you would expect a black comic to say. You know what I mean? So I had...
Those are some like OG alt guys, you know?
Yeah. Alt, sort of cerebral, weird. I think the skill that I gained was being able to try and make that comedy almost bulletproof in any situation and universal in a sort of way, where I don't have to feel like I'm pretending to be a type of person in one room or the other. Like something that fascinated me was there's this, I don't think it exists anymore, but there was this club called Jokes and Notes in the South Side in Bronzeville that had an open mic that really wasn't an open mic. It was an open mic, but still the audience is people who are dressing up and paying to be there. So it's not really an open mic.
It's a lot of pressure.
It's a black club. And Mary Lindsay, the owner, she would have all the comedians who want to be on the open mic line up outside. And then she'd pick people who were on it. But the thing is, it was always so few white comics who would take the trek to Bronzeville to be on this open mic that you're pretty much guaranteed if you're a white comic to get on. And what I'm about to say is not about every white comic that ever went on, but what fascinated me was the same like racial tensions and the racial arguments that people make in all types of media. Like, you know, oh, this black person is just funny to these white people because he's doing the black stuff that he knows white people want to laugh about. Well, you see a white comic in a black club, and maybe it's their first time in a black club, and then you see them quickly go from being the edgy white comic who says all the dark material and no one can tell him what to do. You see them quickly become the goofy white guy who's dancing around and doing jokes like, I'm so silly because I'm white. And you know, so I never wanted to kind of have to go into any of those levels in any situation. So my goal in comedy and everything that I do has always been to try and find a way to be centered, get everything across effectively to the same audience.
At what point did you decide to move into like comedic writing and into the actual entertainment industry?
While I was doing stand-up in Chicago, there's this comedian, Kyle Scanlon, who created this website called The Whiskey Journal. That was sort of his own version of The Onion. And so he had some other comedians and other writers write for this website. I got a lot of skills from that, too. He had this editor who, you know, you'd write headlines and there's a whole process for it. And so I was getting a lot of writing chops from that. And one day Kyle had this podcast equipment that he wasn't using. And he's like, you want to do something with it? Go for it. And so I took that podcasting equipment and was going to make a podcast for the Whiskey Journal. And the two podcasts that I loved at the time were Radiolab and WTF with Mark Maron. So I tried to devise a podcast that was about headlines, a little bit of Mark Maron, a little bit of Radiolab that has a lot of soundscapes and fine-tuned editing. So I came up with this premise called It's All True, which is a podcast where I interview interesting people, usually comedians, for a little bit. Then I ask them to tell me a headline for a funny, true story. Then we dive into the story totally conversationally, but as they're telling the story, there are soundscapes and sound effects that bring the story to life. I started making that in my friend Ian's basement using his laptop because he had the only like fully functional laptop. So, and that was around the time that I was already had that free internship at Vocalo, but then this paid internship opportunity opened up at WBEZ. Joe Dassault was running the podcast department and he had seen me around again because of all the volunteering stuff. You know, so I interviewed with him about the podcast internship. He asked me if I had any podcasts. I told him, but it's all true. He listened to it. He liked it. While I had that internship and he was teaching me a lot about editing, he would give me some tips about editing. It's all true. And it got to the point where my podcast was brought into the WBEZ podcast network. So you would see it on the WBEZ website. And since I had this WBEZ email, I could easily reach out to comedians who were coming into town with this official email address and try to get them on the podcast. So I ended up like interviewing Eddie Izzard and Hari Kondabolu and Wyatt Cenac, who I ended up working with later. And so that helped take me to like a sort of another level. I'm a comedian in Chicago who has some media cred all of a sudden. And so it helped me with stand-up, but it also helped me in the world of general media and sort of entertainment in a sense.
How did that convert into like working for Comedy Central and all the other, like the actual, like the television and all that television writing?
I am going to connect all those dots for you right now.
All right. Blow my mind.
Just to fast forward a little bit out of Chicago, my first official media job. So the Vocalo job was an unpaid internship. WBEZ podcast internship was a paid internship.
How much were you getting paid for the internship?
I don't remember, but it wasn't a lot. But I can't tell you how excited I was because my next official job was working as a video producer for WGN Radio, which is a big radio station in Chicago. So I cannot tell you how happy I was to be a video producer at a radio station and get paid full time. And then after that, 2016, I moved from Chicago to New York. My first job in New York was at Vice as a podcast producer. And I still had that sort of tension of like, I'm doing so much of this work at Vice because this is what I need to make money and survive, but I'm not doing as much stand-up. And I feel like I'm not building the stand-up element of my career. But I also started to focus on the fact that I really wanted to create stuff. I want to write for television. I want to make television. I want to make things of my own. Beyond stand-up, I just want to create things that feel like me, which is a little bit of that same stand-up energy, but more about I want to create things and collaborate with people to create things, that kind of thing. So one lucky thing is that I got a manager because my friend Ian had moved to LA at that point. He had like mentioned me to one manager. And when I went to visit LA just to do a couple shows and visit family, that manager saw me and asked if she could be my manager. And she's still my manager now. So that happened. That was good. So just being able to talk to someone, try and build some building blocks for how to evolve into what I want to be doing was good. But suddenly, little connections I had made in comedy and in media in Chicago started to get into place. Hari Kondabolu, who I had met because I interviewed him on my podcast at WBZ, he had a podcast that he co-hosts with W. Kamau Bell called Politically Reactive. He knew that I was in New York. He knew that I was still a podcast producer, and they had an opening for a podcast producer. So he asked if I could be the podcast producer for that. So that was great because I was moving away from Vice, where I was producing like 10 podcasts for very little money. Wasn't having a great time there. And so I was moving from that to focus on one podcast where the hosts are comedian, or two comedians, and one has a show on CNN. So I'm getting closer to the types of things that I wanted to do. The next opportunity was, I believe Hari had recommended me to write a packet for Wyatt Cenac's new show. He had a show coming out on HBO. And I also had interviewed Wyatt back in Chicago. I wrote a packet for his HBO show. They liked it. I had the interview, but they had a limited number of people that they could bring on as for staff. I think it was like six writers. They still liked me enough that they offered me the job of a web producer. It was still a step forward. And I also knew that like people like Josh Gondelman started as a web producer on Last Week Tonight and then moved up to being a staff writer. And now I believe he's a showrunner of Desus and Mero. So I knew there was a path there. After the first season of Wyatt's show, I got an opportunity to be a digital writer at Comedy Central. And I believe the connection there started from me being on a show with someone who works there. Then that person, after that show, became a mutual friend on Twitter. And so when an opening came at Comedy Central, this guy had seen me in person. He saw that I was consistently doing funny stuff on Twitter. And I already had an official job in the world of web producing for a show on HBO. So that was sort of the holy grail to me, getting this digital writing job at Comedy Central, because I was writing and I could write stuff that would actually get made by an official, like one of the most official comedy brands that exist. I think they were originally looking for people who could sort of be a hybrid writer producer. I kind of talked down my ability to edit video or audio or anything like that, because I really wanted to focus on writing and I really wanted to be a writer. So I really just hyped the fact that like I can write really well. I can write a lot. And so when I got there, I wrote way more than was necessary. One true blessing was that in the cubicle that I had, there was just a Dell computer that didn't have any like software that you could edit anything on. So literally all I could do was write. And some of the sketches that I had produced there, who had written and had gotten produced, definitely came in handy when my manager heard of an opening at the reboot of All That. And so I believe like really what we sent over was a bunch of the sketches that I had written that got produced at Comedy Central, plus, you know, what my resume had looked like at that point. They got me the phone interview. It did very well. Next thing you know, bada bing, bada boom, my first official writing job for television is for the reboot of All That, which was amazing.
Did you grow up watching?
Were you a fan of All That?
Yeah, huge fan. Yeah.
Yeah, we grew up on that too.
Yeah, I was so excited to be on. And I actually have a theory that 90s Nickelodeon and specifically 90s All That is the reason we had Barack Obama as a president, because I think 90s Nickelodeon presented this sort of racial utopic reality that no one, I guarantee you most of the people watching it did not have. Like the fact that Coolio sang the theme song to Kenan and Kel and things like that. Like I think it united the nation and it gave that generation
dude, it was so weird. Like the, like the stuff they had on there is just like, I try to explain to like people like a little younger than us, like they just don't get it. Or like people older than us, like, what is this? It was just the weirdest shit. It was so awesome. Like the stuff they aired.
I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when you think about that, the people who grew up with that, the first opportunity they have to vote is the opportunity to vote for Barack Obama. And so I think that's why the millennial generation supported him, is because of shows like Kenan and Kel and all that. And, you know, the fact that Arnold, Gerald got along so well, you know, this is why we're here. And this is what Donald Trump hates.
I wish we could just end the podcast right there. Such a weird ending, but now it's good, James.
It must be different writing for children, right? are there like guidelines for that, or is it just something you have to feel out?
I don't think it was so difficult for me. I think there are perhaps guidelines, but it really is just a more universal form of comedy. And it's freeing in some ways, and it's also challenging in others, but it's a very stark difference for writing for Comedy Central, where, you know, the demographic audience is more male-leaning, perhaps more white male-leaning, you know, or something, you know, like, and it's a lot of pop culture references. Like, writing for kids makes you realize the tropes of writing for adults. Adults is just pop culture references, something vulgar, something shock, you know what I mean? But kids comedy is kind of for adults too, because kids are usually watching with their parents. And I felt like it was closer to something like Charlie Chaplin. You're usually writing comedy that's kind of broad, and that, especially for a sketch show like all that, that could work for people who don't even know the language, that can work if you watch it on mute. You know, you're writing funny situations that should make people laugh because of just like pure silliness. And the basic things are, yeah, it's funny if someone gets slime on them. It's some, you know, it's funny when Coach Cretan gets hurt in crazy ways. It's funny. You know what I mean? Like, it's just pure funny. It's not too difficult. It's one of the things that I've kind of gained a lot of respect for. I think that people can look down on kids' television, but it's like looking down on the things that made you who you are at the same time. Like, you loved it when you were a kid, didn't you? Like, what's wrong with the people who made the stuff you loved when you were a kid?
I guess that's because, like, you're not writing a show for kids to watch. You're watching a show that kids can enjoy watching, which is also universal. Like, adults can watch it, because, like, obviously you're not writing like SpongeBob or like an actual like kids show. Like, more like the sketch comedy is very universal. That's interesting. Was it hard, like, because I'm sure, like, you might have had staff members on that writing team that did have like a more like adult oriented mind. Like, was it hard to like kind of convert that to something that kids would enjoy watching, or they just want to go over the top and like make it vulgar or weirdly sexual? Like,
anybody get fired for going too far? Were there any like edgy comedians like on the writing staff and all that? It's like,
no, but you know, I don't think a lot of people talk about the fact that Neil Brennan was a writer on the original.
Oh yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I don't think that he lasted long. I don't remember exactly why. But it's very funny to think about, and to think about, you know, Nickelodeon birthed the careers of people like Nick Cannon and stuff.
Yeah.
We're going through the list of like, just, it's such an all-star cast, like looking back at it and all, there's just so many bangers of like cast members. It's insane. Like, those kids' careers. Yeah. And was that weird? Like, cause obviously you watched them as kids and like you kind of grew up with them, and then like you're writing stuff, cause like they brought back a lot of the original cast members. And so was that like weird in a sense, or did it kind of just make sense?
It made sense. And I have this weird thing when it comes to celebrity and people that I admire, that it's more self-deprecating than anything. But the science that happens in my head is like, well, you're meeting me, so you must just be a normal person, because only normal people meet me. You know what I mean?
What's wrong with you? Why are you in my presence?
So I end up treating, you know, celebrities and people that are, not that I treat them like I don't respect them or anything, I just treat them with the same respect as anybody. And like,
yeah, they're regular people.
Yeah, just walk in and say, hey.
They probably appreciate that.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. But it was really cool. I think that I tend to just kind of not think about the coolness until later on.
You're in the car fangirling.
Yeah. it was just great being in the presence of like Lori Beth Denberg and Kel. And Lori Beth Denberg she voices a character in my cartoon that's out right now. Plays Maurice's boss, the angry, self-hating robot. Yeah, it was amazing. And I felt like my comedy, all that really sort of reminded me of what my comedic voice is, because everything that I said clicked more than it has in any other writer's room when I was writing for all that. Like it was such a part of my DNA in a way that it kind of unlocked something that I think you can kind of see in the cartoon as well.
After all that, was it the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon?
Yes, that was after all that. I knew that I was going to, it was like the job that I had lined up for after that season of all that I was on, excited about it. And then while I was still in LA working on all that, the pandemic hit and I rushed back to New York because like I had no idea. This is how I knew I was going to make money. No one knew exactly what was going to happen. There were these like rumors circulating that New York was going to go on lockdown. They weren't going to let anybody in or out. And so in my mind, I'm like, well, like, I don't know what's going to happen. Like, I have to get to New York and start working for the Tonight Show because this might be the only money that I can make to like help my parents or something. You know what I mean? Luckily enough, like it feels like that was like a spot where because I hadn't started yet, the Tonight Show could have decided, yeah, we're not going to bring anybody on, but they still kept their word. And I started writing when Jimmy was in his house. I worked for the Tonight Show from my apartment. My entire time writing for the Tonight Show was in my apartment for a year and a half. I've never met Jimmy Fallon in person. I've never met 98% of my coworkers in person.
Wow.
It was a very, very Twilight Zone experience. I've never set foot in 30 Rock for the show.
You feel like you're robbed a little bit?
Maybe a little bit, but it's also like, I feel like, did it even really happen? That was really the feeling. The whole time was like, am I even really writing for a show? Like, is anything really happening? Because I had to recalibrate what the joys were, because it's not like you're producing a sketch or a game and you're meeting the celebrity in person and you get this rush. You have to rush these index cards to Jimmy and then you get to hear the warm-up comic live, warming up the crowd. And then you get to hear how the jokes land with the crowd in person. It was kind of none of that. So it felt very bizarre in a way. Because I had started writing for it when it was in Jimmy's house all the way up until it was in the normal studio with an audience, I feel like I wrote for 5 different versions of a late night show. And so the skills I got from all of those transitions of technique and what it takes to make a show function, by the way, like mostly using like Slack and email and stuff, are things that I'll keep with me for the rest of my life, because it's a lot of just weird little detailed skills were needed to make it possible.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you about like the writing rooms comparatively from like all that to like the Tonight Show, but obviously the Tonight Show, you probably had like a weird experience where it's probably not like a typical writing room.
Yeah.
Where like you said, it was all Slack and emails. Like, but from like a writing perspective, was it a bit more freeing working for the Tonight Show compared to all that, or did you have more freedom with all that?
I think I had more freedom at all that late night, and especially the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, just like a fast moving train. Process feels like working in a submarine. You know what I mean? Because it's a very regimented sort of set of things that need to be done, but there's always a show every single day. You kind of know what's coming ahead of you because you have a sense of what guests are coming on, but the levels of the process of getting something approved and getting a celebrity on board is its own thing. The levels of, let's say you have something that has the green light to be produced, and then you as a person who pitched it, you are in charge of having it produced. So an example is I came up with this game when Seth Rogen had that pickle movie, an American Pickle, that came out. So I pitched a game called the Pickle Juice Challenge, where Jimmy and Seth ask each other pickle related trivia questions, and whoever gets it wrong has to take a shot of pickle juice. So I pitched that. Then I have to come up with the trivia questions. I have to talk to the graphics people about how to make the pickle points. I have to talk to the lighting person who says, oh, I think it would be cool if there's a greenish light behind Jimmy. I have to figure out how to send pickles to Seth Rogen. That's an example of how it becomes all of those skills that you gain from other types of media work. They come in handy. Yeah, that's the type of thing that is. And that's not necessarily the case for a show like All That. Like All That, it was you pitch the ideas, they get the green light, you rewrite it. But usually the executive producers, the head writers, they handle all of those because they're in charge of the overall vision and everything. So certain decisions are kind of left out of your hands. But this is very hands-on. And so it's also a great thing to learn how to produce something and how to deal with all of those nuances. And everyone is sort of the middleman because it's not like you're totally in charge of this. You still have to get, you know, your higher ups to approve it and all the way up to Jimmy approving it. So
yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of red tape and a lot of like,
yeah. It's like Congress. I should have said that. Congress. It's like, yeah.
how many shows ahead are you guys like with writing? Are you 1 or 2 days ahead? Or are you writing the show as it's?
I think it's usually just like a combination of stuff. I would say usually like two or three days maybe. I'm trying to remember because every show has its own sort of internal logic. And I've now written for sketch late night and a narrative live action sitcom, and now this cartoon that I have coming out. So. And I've kind of made those decisions purposefully because I want to just have a wide ranging resume. And as a Black person in the entertainment industry, you got to be able to prove yourself.
Multi-hyphenate.
Exactly.
Right.
Do you have a preference of like writing either like sketch or late night or animated series?
I kind of embrace it all. I really, really do love sketch. But narrative, I think, is something that I think my future is in. It's all just about the moment that you create something that people really connect to and want more of. I love creating worlds. Like technically, the first writer's room I was ever in was in elementary school. My friends and I, who were obsessed with the Power Rangers, we would come up with characters and plot lines and storylines. And that is my favorite part of it all, is that sort of communal fun and creation of rules in a world. You would think I'd like playing Dungeons and Dragons, but I've never played it in my life. But I love that. It's just so much fun.
Did you guys ever write jokes for the guests? Did you ever write like any kind of monologue stuff for the guests?
Are you talking about like things that they would say if they're on the couch?
Yeah. Did the writers ever write for them?
I don't know, because I was on the sketch side. It's kind of split between sketch writers and monologue writers.
Okay.
It could be the case that maybe some people secretly do that and some people are left out of the loop of it. I don't know. But I don't think that's the case. I know that the people who do a pre-interview with all the guests. And so there might be a process there of figuring out what's potentially worth mining from that pre-interview. Maybe there are some suggestions that come. It's possible, but I'm kind of out of the loop on.
So I definitely want to talk to you about your animated series. Like, how did that come about? Like, how did you make the decision to do an animated series?
It came about in the summer of 2020, this very challenging time for America. You know, everyone's on lockdown. There's a global virus pandemic. Then there was the murder of George Floyd. And then there was protests, racial reckoning protests that spanned across the globe. And at the same time, I'll never forget it, Elon Musk sent the first private spacecraft. And to me, that was like clearest that I could imagine it all being laid out. You kind of couldn't write it. And yet it was happening before our eyes. Two jobs before, I was working at Comedy Central. A sort of pandemic project of mine was creating this webcomic called Uncertain Life that was illustrated by this friend of mine and this artist who works at Comedy Central named Grant Lindahl. So we had been collaborating on this weekly webcomic and heard some rumblings that Comedy Central was interested in specifically Black writers to develop something in the animated space. When I heard about that, I just kind of filtered everything that I had been thinking about for a couple of years already, because I had already solidified in my mind, we're going to be on Mars in about 20 years or so. So what does that mean about race? What does that mean about society? What does that mean about culture? What does that mean about music? What does that mean about religion? When you have that setting of Mars, I vaguely had this idea for something. I didn't know if it was a short story or something animated, but the only premise was it's a bodega. It's a corner store on Mars and weird people walk in and out. Then in the summer of 2020, when everything was happening, I kind of filtered everything into this concept of Maurice on Mars, which is about this struggling Black artist named Maurice who works at a coffee shop on Earth in the future. And he sneaks onto a shuttle to the first utopic Martian colony. The only job he can get there is also at a coffee shop. And since he snuck on, he didn't get the mandatory fact inhibitor chip that everyone else has that blocks certain Earth memories to keep things utopic and to keep the peace. So he is literally the only person who can see that this utopia is just recycling the same old Earth problems with a new spin on it. So he's kind of Mars's only hope. He's the only truth teller on Mars, which is a very heady premise for something that would just be a series of 5-minute episodes. But I pitched that and it got the green light, and it was just like an evolution. Like, I was just looking at some of the first pitch and it changed a little bit along the way in terms of like the logic that I had for the episodes and some of the characters and whatnot. But I'm very happy with the result. The animation process is very fun and also a little challenging. But once I got the hang of it, it's just great. And being able to work with animators and illustrators and artists and character designers, every step of it is just fun. Like, any update I had about it along the way, like, I've been working on this for 2 years now, was just exciting. And I'm glad that it's finally out.
There's one episode out now, right?
So three episodes are out now.
Okay,
cool. Three episodes.
Yeah. How many episodes did you get greenlit?
I got 5 episodes greenlit. Okay. And the Comedy Central narrowed it down to their favorite 3, and I agreed. And I'm not sure. Like, I was very looped out in terms of what the budget is, so there might have been budgetary reasons for that, because I packed in a lot into these scripts. But yeah, start off as 5. Ultimately, it's 3 episodes that are coming out with, if people really like it, the opportunity for more.
Cool, cool.
Okay. And they're all 5-minute episodes?
All 5 minutes, yeah. Okay. I think they're like technically less, like 4 minutes and 40 seconds or something like that. Yeah.
So if it does well, either do more 5-minute episodes or maybe convert it to like a 30-minute series? Is there like those kind of talks, or is that the goal?
That's the goal. My goal is for this to become a show, but I think it could just be more 5-minute episodes, which I would love as well, because I've invested a lot in these characters. I have a lot of possibilities that they could go and theories about their backstories. And so I wrote these in a way where when they start, you feel like starting in the middle of something. And when they end, you feel like you can project where it could go. And I did that very purposefully so that people could get the feeling that this could be a show, and that they want to explore more about these characters. And I think that, especially in episode 1, like, I'm very proud of, for, I think it's funny, the reveal of the fact that Maurice is on Mars, and it ends in a way that kind of resets, but also you can imagine some potential extra chaos at the end.
Yeah, no, it was very good. And I like the inhibitor chip. It seems so plausible. And it was like, fuck, dude. Yeah. I can totally see Elon just...
Well, yeah, he's got Neuralink like already built in. Yeah. The trip to Mars.
Do you still own the premise and the idea, or did they buy that all out from you?
You know what? I also still don't remember. This is why I need to get a lawyer now. I hope that I do. For God's sakes, Maurice looks like me. I'm his voice. I don't think that I think I have enough natural ownership of this that it can.
Look what they did to Chappelle, so you never know.
Ari Shaffir too. You
know? Yeah, yeah. But I'm still at that phase of my career where I'm still making a name for myself, essentially. So I'm kind of okay with things now in that lane. I truly don't remember what this deal is.
That's so awesome. I find it more entertaining than like you said. Yeah, we roped in. I have options for like. Nah, I don't remember my sign, dude. Whatever. Yeah, they want to make my show. I don't care. Yeah. What was it surreal though? Like actually them like green lighting it and stuff, or did you like was there points where you just assumed it wasn't going anywhere? We just didn't really think it was actually going to happen, and then like make that turn.
There were there was a point where it had been green lit, and then there was a bit of a limbo situation because there were some internal shifts at Comedy Central. And I believe that it was just like a little bit after the merger of Viacom CBS. So I wasn't sure what was going to happen with it. And then I was pretty miserable about it too, because it was like the one I really needed my extracurricular activities outside of the Tonight Show, because the Tonight Show is like sucking all my energy in. And in a way that was just like, I'm sitting in one spot in my apartment. I'm not even going outside, and it's sucking up all my. So when that kind of went into limbo, I was very sad about it. And then very excited when it kind of came back. And I think it came back because a lot of people at Comedy Central kind of cared about the project and liked it a lot. So when it came back, we went into hyperspeed to make sure that you know, reaching out to potential cast members, picking the animation studio. I was very happy to bring this artist that I love named Uche, who has this great webcomic called Vibe Check. I brought him on to design all of the characters. And we worked with this animation company, Cartoona. And yeah, it was like a week or so of locking down the cast, sending them mics, and then, you know, figuring out their schedules to record each of them individually.
Were you involved in the casting at all, or was it all Comedy Central?
It was a mix of both. We both had our recommendations or people that we like. Comedy Central always has its eye on certain people too, so that they wanted to bring certain people into the mix. But ultimately, I wanted Lori Beth Denberg. I got this great comedian, Dwayne Kennedy, to voice this regular character named Joe, who's sort of a side character who's always reading a weird book and saying funny comments. And some of the best jokes in each episode are just things that he totally ad-libbed. Something that I love about the animation process is that with every extra individualized step, there's the potential to find something new or to add something new that you never would have thought of otherwise. That still feels very collaborative.
We usually ask one last question of our guests. Any words of wisdom for an aspiring writer looking to get into the industry that you wish you would have got when you first started out?
I think it is to create the stuff and not worry about embarrassment, because most people won't remember. It's kind of the same rules of stand-up, especially at open mics, where no one's really going to remember that you bombed at an open mic. People are only going to remember when you do it incredibly well, like when you kill. But everyone is so focused on their own stuff that no one's going to remember. And also, if you bomb for most of your set, but then the last joke gets a huge laugh, no one's going to remember anything about your set except for that last thing that made them laugh. So try and use that logic in everything, I think.
Yeah. It's like no one remembers the blunders. It's always the victories. Yeah.
That'd be a strange dude. He's like, I want to be known for bombing. Yeah. Have you noticed that nobody ever remembers the bombs?
Yeah.
I want people to remember my bombs.
That'd be really bad bombs. He'd like literally like walk the audience. Like this guy walks the audience every night. This is ridiculous. Tim, it's been an absolute blast having you on our podcast this evening.
Yeah, man, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's been fun.
If you put some specific music behind here, you got yourself a good sleep podcast, because I'm sure beyond a doubt that I've put most of the listeners to sleep.
No.
They're going to wake up and they're not going to know what happened. Some other podcast is playing. They fell asleep on this one, and then they're going to wake up to your podcast with Malia Obama, and they're not going to know what happened.
Yeah, don't sleep on Tim Barnes. That's all I got to say.
That should be the name of your comedy special. It'll be awesome. Speaking of comedy specials, where can our listeners find more of you and your work at?
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter at TimBarnes451. That's the temperature at which jokes burn. You can also follow me on TimBarnesComedy.com. Get all the info about things I worked on and things that are in the works. And look up Maurice on Mars. That's the most important thing I want from you right now. And if you like it, give it a like, give it a nice comment, share it with people you think might like it, because that could go a long way. And if you like it, maybe it could become a show. Who knows?
Tim, thanks for coming out tonight.
Yeah, appreciate it. That was good.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is a lot of fun. And seriously, whenever you want me back on, I'll be happy to.
Yeah, man, absolutely. Be fun.
Yeah.
All right, Tim. Whenever you want to leave, feel free to leave.
All right. So, well, and do you have to stop the recording before I leave? Will it?
No.
No, you're good. We're going to talk about you a little bit when you leave.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Talk about yeah, we do. Yeah, we do a post show and all.
Oh, that's the Patreon. The Patreon.
No.
Talk shit about the...
A little bit. Sometimes. Yeah. But like,
usually we have guests that talk shit about other people that we put on Patreon.
Yeah. It's like one guy, he had all these stories about with the carpool karaoke guy. I forget his name.
Oh, James Corden.
James Corden.
Oh, he had like a 20-minute rant of how he was.
Yeah, he's just talking about
how. Oh my goodness! And he used to. Wow! And this is on the Patreon.
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Over there. Yeah. Well, you got gold on your hands.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. I believe in you. Have a good one.
Thanks, Tim.
You too, man. I actually found a lot what he was saying like very interesting. getting your own show, especially on Comedy Central, like that's such a pinnacle as an achievement for probably the majority of writers, but also like working on like the Tonight Show with Fallon, like that's awesome. And then like all that plus the other stuff he's done. He's done quite a bunch of really cool things.
I like that his archetypes were Woody Allen and Stephen Wright. That was cool.
Yeah, I was definitely I was expecting.
That was the first on our show, I think.
Yeah, most people don't really talk about Woody Allen.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he did something, right? He did something bad. What did he do? He married his stepdaughter. But it was after she turned 18. So
yeah, but like he changed her diapers or something ridiculous.
Yeah, it is weird. It's like you're building your future wife.
You're
raising your future wife. That's
definitely insane. Grooming to the
I was joking about the 18-year-old thing. It's disgusting. It's all around disgusting.
No, I do like that Tim like has like such a solid like stand-up background as well. I always find it interesting of like when you convert that into something different, because he did pivot not drastically, but it is still a pivot, like of doing like television writing.
I think it's definitely aligned. There's a lot of these like writing and podcasting, like a lot of these things, like for comedy, it's great for comedy, mm-hmm. you know, like just expand your mind, like the improv too, you know, like I think all of that's great. And like, you know, I mean, like for podcasting, like talking into a microphone, I think seems to lend itself to, you know, coming up with ideas and finding your voice and all that.
Yeah. Speaking of podcasting, is his podcast show of like actually getting like really awesome guests. That's awesome. That especially he did say like he didn't like the click building of stand-up. But a lot of his career was built on like clicks and like people knowing people and knowing the right person.
I think what he was saying was he didn't really fit in. I don't think the click itself bothered him. He just felt like an outsider. Something I very much relate to. Like even when you do have a group of friends, you're still kind of your own entity. You know, moving between things. You know what I mean?
No, I don't know what you mean.
Yeah, well, that's
the whole fucking point of this. So yeah, so Tim was a great guy. Definitely excited to see more of his career. I'm excited for his show. Definitely a cool premise and all. I always love animation, so
yeah,
good discussions.
Timmy B's makes me feel good. Thank you all for listening. If you would like to support the WWSD podcast, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/WWSD_podcast. Make sure you like and subscribe on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Haven't put you to sleep yet. Sorry.
I mean, if we had unique names for the episodes, it would be like, can I put you to sleep yet?
It's starting to get funny after the fifth time.
Have I woken you up yet?
Oh, we're very woke here.